Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the CFR Academic Conference Call Series. I'm Elena Faskianis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org, if you'd like to share it with your colleagues or classmates. We're delighted to have Rachel Vogelstein with us today to discuss U.S. foreign policy and the rights of women and girls. Ms. Vogelstein is CFR's Fellow for Women and Foreign Policy. She is the author of the recent CFR report, Ending Child Marriage. She is also an adjunct professor of women's rights at Georgetown University. From 2009 to 2012, she was director of policy and senior advisor in the Office of Global Women's Issues at the U.S. State Department. Ms. Vogelstein represented the State Department as a member of the White House Council of Women and Girls. An attorney by training, she is the recipient of the Secretary of State Superior Honor Award and National Association of Women Lawyers Award. Rachel, thank you very much for being with us today. It would be terrific if you give us an overview of the what you consider to be the biggest threats to the rights of women and girls worldwide, and why protecting these rights is such a priority for the U.S. and the international community.
Thank you so much. I want to start by thanking Arena for hosting today's call, and to all of you for participating in the call today and for your interest in CFR's work on women and foreign policy. CFR has had a women and foreign policy program for over a decade and is really at the forefront of scholarship and thought leadership in this area. So today I want to talk to you all about why gender equality is critical to achieving U.S. foreign policy objectives. And then I'll discuss the issue of child marriage as a case study of how the status of women and girls affects prosperity, stability, and security. And then I will look forward to answering your questions. So first, why is gender equality critical to achieving U.S. foreign policy objectives? I'd like to make the case to you all today that in order to achieve successful outcomes for U.S. foreign policy priorities, including stability, prosperity, and peace, we need to focus on gender equality and advancing the political, economic, social, and cultural status of women and girls. And the evidence to support this strategic imperative is really clear. Research indicates that investment in women's employment, health, and education is correlated with a range of positive outcomes, including greater economic growth. And a growing body of evidence shows that women offer unique contributions to making and keeping peace. And engaging women as social and political actors can change policy choices and make institutions more representative and better performing. So let's review the evidence to support this theory. Consider, for example, economic growth. Research shows that if we address the barriers to women's economic participation, we can fundamentally transform economies. For example, the World Economic Forum produces a global gender gap report that shows that where the gender gap is closest to being closed in a range of areas, including access to education, health survivability, economic participation, and political participation, countries and economies are more competitive and prosperous. Eliminating barriers that prevent women from working in certain occupations or in certain sectors could reduce the productivity gap by a third to one-half and increase output per worker by 3 to 25% across a range of countries. And this is really true across the globe. Research shows that reductions in barriers to female labor force participation would increase the size of the Eurozone's GDP by 13%, Japan's by 16%, and narrowing the gender gap could lead to a 14% rise in per capita incomes by the year 2020 in China, Russia, Indonesia, the Philippines, Vietnam, and Korea. So this is really true all over the world. We also see the benefits of women's empowerment in agriculture. For example, the Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that if women had access to the same productive resources that men do, that they could increase yields on their farms by 20 to 30%. And that increase could raise total agricultural output in developing countries by 2.5 to 4% and could reduce the number of hungry people in the world by an estimated 12 to 17%, or up to 150 million people. So all of these economic benefits go unfulfilled when the status of women and girls remains low. Peace and security is another U.S. foreign policy objective that is furthered by the full participation of women. Evidence shows that including women in peace processes leads to better outcomes, not just for women, but for entire societies. According to research conducted by the International Crisis Group in Sudan, Congo, and Uganda, women who participate in peace talks often raise issues like human rights, security, justice, employment, education, and health care that are fundamental to reconciliation and to rebuilding, and therefore to a lasting and sustainable peace. You know, there's a great story that Secretary Clinton used to tell and likely still mentions about a peace negotiation that was taking place in which women were excluded, and so they were shut out of the negotiation, and the men were going back and forth negotiating over one particular river. And they went for several rounds, and they weren't making any progress. And one of the men came out of the negotiation, and the women on the outside said, you know, what's going on? What's happening? And the man reported that they were negotiating over this river, and the women said, that's ridiculous. That river has been dry for years, which, of course, the women knew, since women are the ones in that society who actually go to fetch the water. So it really shows that different perspectives are instrumental and that having all voices at the table can really lead to stronger and more sustainable outcomes. Studies also suggest not only that higher levels of gender equality and women's physical security are linked to security and peacefulness, but also that reductions in inequality and improvements to women's security can be important foundations for stability. So data from 1954 to 1994 illustrate that states with higher levels of gender equality use less violence to manage crises than states with lower levels of gender equality. So all of this goes to show that including women in peace and security negotiations and processes can really further stronger outcomes, not just for women, but for entire societies. Political participation of women is also critical to U.S. interests in promoting democracy. Including women is critical to the strength of democratic and representative institutions. And leveling the playing field, so meaning essentially that women and men have equal opportunity to become socially and politically active, to make decisions and to shape policies, has been shown to lead over time to more inclusive and representative institutions and policy choices. And we've seen some really interesting research about what happens when women are in leadership roles. For example, in India, a study demonstrated that women-led villages had greater investment in drinking water and infrastructure, increased rates of childhood immunizations, lower gender gaps in school attendance, lower levels of corruption, and greater levels of political participation by women than male-led villages. So it's certainly the case that research is showing that the political participation of women is critical to the strength of democratic and representative institutions. And finally, evidence has long supported the notion that development objectives are advanced by promoting the status of women and girls. Investment in women and girls and reductions in gender equality can not only improve efficiency and economic growth, but they also improve health and education for the next generation. Research shows that women disproportionately spend more of their earned income on food, healthcare, home improvement, and schooling, which has a multiplier effect in local communities. And we know that maternal health and mortality is closely linked to child survivability, so investments in women's health, and in particular in family planning, have important ramifications for the health of children and families writ large, and actually can set the stage for rapid economic growth. We also see that the education of women and girls has been shown to improve not only their own health outcomes, but also the health and educational outcomes of their children. About half of the reductions of child mortality between 1970 and 1990 can be attributed to increased educational attainment in women of reproductive age. And in addition, we know that children of educated mothers are more likely to be educated themselves. So those are just a few of the statistics that show that promoting gender equality and advancing the status of women is not just the right thing to do, but is the smart thing to do. And it's critical to achieving the diplomatic and development aims that we seek in the U.S. Today, this strategic objective is reflected in a range of U.S. policies that govern our work in foreign affairs and in development. The U.S. National Security Strategy, for example, specifically recognizes that countries are more peaceful and prosperous when women are accorded full and equal rights and opportunity, and when those rights and opportunities are denied, that countries lag behind. That's a pretty important statement, really stemming from the very top of our government. In addition, Secretary Clinton, when she was in office, instituted something called the Quadrennial Diplomacy and Development Review, which is essentially a policy planning document for the State Department and the U.S. Agency for International Development. And when she produced this in 2010, the document placed women squarely at the center of U.S. diplomacy and development, not simply as beneficiaries, but as agents of peace, reconciliation, development, growth, and stability. And the Quadrennial Diplomacy and Development Review actually directed the State Department and the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, to integrate a focus on gender equality across our diplomatic and development efforts. So that was a pretty important step forward. To realize the vision that was outlined in the National Security Strategy and in the Quadrennial Diplomacy and Development Review, which also goes by the acronym QDDR, the State Department and USAID issued policy guidance to implement a strategic focus on gender in March of 2012. And both sets of policy guidance at the State Department and USAID are complementary and require that gender equality is incorporated in a few ways: in policy development, in strategic planning and budgetary planning, in implementation of policies and programs, in management and training, and importantly, in monitoring and evaluation of results. In addition, the U.S. recently released two strategies to strengthen our conflict resolution and peace processes through the inclusion of women and to combat gender-based violence around the world. So in December of 2011, the U.S. issued a National Action Plan on Women, Peace, and Security, which was accompanied by a presidential executive order directing its implementation. And in August of 2012, the U.S. released a strategy to prevent and respond to gender-based violence globally, which was also accompanied by an executive order. So there are now a host of policies that really embed a strategic focus on gender equality in our foreign policy and development work. So the question that this raises is how do these policies actually work in practice? And how can we address intractable traditions or practices that limit the potential of women and girls through our own foreign policy and development work? And to answer that, I'd like to talk briefly about the issue of child marriage. Child marriage is a topic that I recently wrote about in a Council on Foreign Relations report that came out earlier this year. And we produced this report under the guidance of a group of prominent experts in international development, women and girls empowerment, and the domestic and international policy communities. And members of the council included Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who has taken on this issue in a big way as a member of the elders, also Norwegian Prime Minister Gro Harlem Brundtland, Mrs. Sarah Brown, who together with former Prime Minister Gordon Brown has taken on this issue, and in particular the issue of girls' education, and representatives from the U.S. government, from the United Nations, and elsewhere. There are a few things to know about child marriage just as background, and then I'll talk a little bit about how this issue is an example of why the U.S. really needs to focus on women's rights and the rights of girls in pursuing our foreign policy and development objectives. Child marriage is actually far more prevalent than I think most people realize. The number of women married as children is quite staggering. The UN estimates that about 1 in 3 women aged 20 to 24, so about 70 million, was married under the age of 18. And we know that many are far younger than that. There are nearly 5 million girls married under the age of 15 every year, which is about 13,000 every day. Some, we know from stories and anecdotes, are married as young as 8 or 9 years old. And this practice occurs across regions, across cultures, across religions. We know that India actually accounts for about 40% of the world's known child brides. But the tradition is also pervasive elsewhere in South Asia, across Sub-Saharan Africa, and in parts of Latin America and the Middle East. So how does this issue affect U.S. foreign policy interests? There are a few different ways that I think are worth highlighting in particular. One issue is economic growth. Research suggests that child marriage often curtails education for young girls. Girls are pulled out of school in order to get married. And in parts of Sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, for example, we see that many girls fail to make the transition from primary to secondary education, in part because of this issue. And yet we also know that even one extra year of schooling beyond average can increase women's wages by 10 to 20%. And in fact, the World Bank study suggests that a 1 percentage point increase in the share of women with a secondary education raises a country's annual per capita income growth by 0.3%. So these benefits, these economic benefits, vanish from the global economy when girls' education is cut short by marriage and they're pulled out of the educational system. We also know, and the report I recently wrote highlights new research, that girls are actually more likely to become single mothers through divorce, abandonment, or widowhood, so through the route of marriage, than they are through out-of-wedlock birth, which I think runs contrary to a lot of the predispositions that folks might have about single motherhood in the developing world. So economic growth is certainly affected by this practice. Global health is as well. And that's another important priority that the U.S. focuses on through its development work. We know that early marriage begets early pregnancy and childbearing, and that's, in fact, the leading cause of death for girls aged 15 to 19 in the developing world. And even when young mothers do survive, the health of their children is jeopardized. We know that stillbirths and infant mortality are about 50% more likely when mothers are under the age of 20, and the risks of prematurity, of low birth weight, of childhood malnutrition all increase as well. So these poor health outcomes undercut the substantial U.S. investments that we make in global health programs and, of course, also contribute to poverty and instability. Security is also implicated by the practice of child marriage. Research suggests that child marriage is associated with instability, and, in fact, one analysis shows that most of the 25 countries with the highest prevalence of child marriage are either fragile states or at high risk of natural disaster. And we see reports from war-torn states such as Syria or Afghanistan or drought-stricken countries like Niger that confirm that families often pursue child marriage in an attempt to preserve resources in crisis situations, and yet perpetuation of this practice in weak states only serves to exacerbate poverty, illiteracy, poor health, and instability in places that are already overwhelmed by complex challenges. The U.S. has recently elevated the issue of child marriage on its foreign policy agenda, and there are several ways that we can address this issue and strengthen the objectives that we seek through our foreign policy work and our development work by addressing this issue. First, the U.S., specifically the State Department, recently in 2012, under the leadership of former Secretary Hillary Clinton, included the issue of child marriage in its human rights reports. It's a mandatory reporting requirement for the first time. So for the first time, all countries have to report on the rate of child marriage in their countries. And that will give an important source of information as we all continue to work on this issue going forward. In addition, Congress has also elevated this issue on the agenda. And in March, enacted a provision as part of the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act that actually requires the Secretary of State to develop a U.S. strategy to combat child marriage. And now that the new ambassador at large for global women's issues has been confirmed at the State Department, her name is Kathy Russell, I think all eyes are on her and on Secretary Kerry to see what that strategy will look like. And there's a few recommendations that I make in the report that I'll highlight for all of you as ways that the U.S. can continue to push this issue higher on the agenda and strengthen our foreign policy outcomes by addressing child marriage. One recommendation is to elevate this issue in our diplomacy. So the U.S. has, for example, regular strategic dialogues with countries like India, where, as I mentioned, about 40% of the world's known child brides reside. We should make sure this is at the top of the agenda in dialogues like that. We can also join with allies like the UK, the Norwegians, the Canadians, the Australians, all of whom have programs or a strong interest in this issue, to make sure that we're coordinating our programs on the ground and leveraging our efforts. We can also make sure that child marriage is an issue that's addressed through the post-2015 development goal process. As many of you likely know, there are Millennium Development Goals that were set in 2000 that the world has been working towards and will expire in 2015, and there's a process underway now to consider what development goals the world will set post-2015 going forward. And already there's heartening news that in the report produced by a high-level panel appointed by the Secretary General at the United Nations, that child marriage was included, and in fact, there was a recommendation that a goal be set that child marriage be eradicated by 2030, which is an ambitious goal. But the U.S. has a really important role to play in continuing to push this issue on the international agenda, on the post-2015 agenda, as we head towards 2015. In addition to diplomacy, the U.S. can also increase funding, and I'm mindful that I'm making that comment at a time where funding is very much an issue in Washington. But even if additional funding is not possible because we don't expect additional funding anytime soon given our budgetary situation, there's a lot we can do with existing resources. And so a third recommendation is that we really need to target the resources that we spend to make sure that we're appropriately addressing this issue. So we spend a lot in the areas of global health, education, economic growth, democracy promotion, human rights, and the rule of law through our diplomatic and development efforts. And if we're not adequately integrating this issue, we're not going to see the outcomes we could. So there are a few areas in particular that we highlight in the report, maternal and child health in particular, because of the strong link between child marriage and maternal and child mortality, family planning because of the large numbers of already married girls who have an unmet need for family planning, and importantly, girls' secondary education because we know that education is so closely linked to age at marriage. A fourth recommendation about what the U.S. can do is really promote monitoring and evaluation. We need to better track our expenditures on programs to end this practice. And we also need better data collection. So there are parts of the world, in particular in the Middle East and North Africa, where we just don't have enough information about how prevalent this practice is. In fact, about half of the countries in that region do not provide information to the UN about the prevalence rate of child marriage. So we think that the problem may be bigger than we even know, and we really need to be doing more to promote data collection in that area and in others. So I'll pause there to answer any questions that you all have, and I look forward to our conversation.
Terrific. That was a great and thorough, albeit a little depressing too, the stats are just mind-boggling presentation, Rachel. Let's open up to questions from the students.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the 1 key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order they are received. Again, that is star 1 to ask a question. Our first question comes from Tuskegee University.
Yeah, you can just speak. Hi, how are you doing? My name's Cody Lacey.
Hi, nice to talk to you.
Oh, hi, how are you doing? My question for you was, why are we so concerned about foreign affairs when we face these problems in the United States, such as child, like these, not child marriage, but there's like underground human trafficking in Texas. There's a lot of different what I want to say, situations with children that are illegal that pose a threat to this nation. Actually, why are we so concerned with what the foreigners are doing?
That's a great question, and I think you raise an important point that there's a lot of progress that needs to be made right here at home in the United States. Trafficking is an issue you flagged, which is a serious issue both here and around the world, and I absolutely believe that we need to be working on those issues and addressing them here, and there are some really important programs, government programs, but also programs that are run by nonprofit organizations and religious organizations, et cetera, to do that work. I think there is a case to be made, though, for why we should care about these issues around the world. We live in a globalized world today, and we've seen throughout our history how the situation of people in other parts of the world actually affects our own interests here at home. And so the case I would really make is that the status of women and girls around the world is a security issue. It really affects our security here. We know from research that countries where women and girls are closer to being equal with men in a range of areas, economically, in terms of education, in terms of access to health care and political participation, those countries are more stable. And in fact, there's really interesting research that shows, for example, that a strong indicator of instability is the child mortality rate in countries around the world. So that's something that folks might not think of as an issue that is related to stability and security, and in fact, it's an important kind of canary in the coal mine. And I think a really strong case can be made from the evidence that the status of women and girls is similar. And when you have political and economic instability around the world, I think there are many examples of how that affects U.S. security interests. So notably, the fact that the U.S. national security strategy now addresses the importance of advancing the status of women and girls and of gender equality around the world, I think, is a really strong testament from really the top of our government that this is an issue that is not one that is soft or secondary, but is actually central to the security interests that we all have.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from United States Military Academy at West Point.
Hi. So my question is kind of the approach you're taking towards it. You know, one of the approaches towards the drug trade in Latin America is that the drug trade exists because of instability already. It's an outgrowth of instability. You seem to be taking the approach that the instability in a lot of these countries where there are significant inequality is an outgrowth of the inequality itself, rather than the inequality being an aspect of the instability and of the situation in those countries, along with a wide array of other factors. Do you think that it's possible that the inequality is not the cause of the instability, but the other way around?
I think that there's a cycle here. I mean, there's certainly, I think it really is true on kind of both counts that the inequality that exists contributes to poverty and instability. But I think what you're saying is also true. So I think it really is a cycle.
Next question.
Our next question comes from Richard Stockton College.
Hello. What possibilities and potential prosperity would be gained if there were to be a woman president in the U.S. or other countries in the developing world?
That's a great question. And since I know we have academic folks on the call today, something that I will flag is that while there is really important research on the effect of women's leadership, particularly women's political leadership, but also civic engagement by women, one of the areas I think where we actually do need more and stronger research is political participation for women. And in part, the reason that we don't have as much evidence as I think we would like to have is because women's leadership is relatively new, just historically speaking. So we are seeing for the first time, you know, a record number of women heads of state. We are seeing record numbers of women representing their communities in national legislatures and parliament and at the local level. But there's a lot that we still don't know. So we still don't know, for example, the effect of women's representation at the municipal level. That's a big hole in the research that we have. And I think that there's an outstanding question about the extent to which women's leadership styles result in different policy outcomes as compared to men. That said, you know, I did cite some statistics earlier in the conversation that show that there are likely policy outcomes that are different when you have women in leadership roles and at the table. So the example I gave about women-led villages in India, in the panchayats, where we see that there are different outcomes. We see greater immunization, we see greater health, we see greater educational outcomes, and in fact, in that particular instance, lower levels of corruption in women-led villages as compared to male-led villages. So I think it's an interesting question that warrants more research, and I think that there's already some interesting evidence that suggests that at the very least there may be differences, and that having a diversity of opinions at the table can make institutions more representative and stronger.
Thank you. Next question.
Next question comes from Maxwell School of Syracuse University.
Hi. This question kind of plays off the last speakers, and I think it's especially instructive for those of us who are in the education field. How do we, as policymakers and advocates, increase not only the number of women that are at the table in negotiations, but also ensure that there are more women leading those negotiations? So essentially, how do we create a paradigm where women increasingly play the role of Thabo Mbeki or Kofi Annan instead of are solely relegated to working on negotiations around the role of women or human rights issues? Thank you.
It's a great question. I think, you know, as a policy matter, governments have a really important role to play. So let's take the U.S. government, since what we focus on in CFR is U.S. foreign policy. You know, by insisting that negotiations proceed only when there are women at the table, we already change the game and make kind of a lasting contribution. So anywhere that the U.S. is involved, if we make that a kind of precondition of the work that we do, that's going to have a transformative effect. And that is something that I think we've seen our leaders, particularly in recent years, insist upon. It can make a really important difference. Negotiations, for example, in places like Afghanistan, making sure that we hear from women themselves and that they're not relegated to the sidelines can make a big difference. I think there's actually a lot of research out there on encouraging women to raise their voices and run. I think there are kind of two things at play. One is that there are a whole host of stereotypes that exist about women's ability to lead. That's true around the world and also right here in the United States. So programs and education to address those stereotypes is critical. And also making sure that women have the resources to run so that if they do raise their hand, that they have the ability, that they have the dollars, that they have the networks to succeed. And that's something, again, that is a need around the world, including right here in the U.S.
Thank you. Next question.
Next question comes from Morehouse College.
Hi, this is Imani Franklin, and I have two questions. One is similar to one question before, which is when you're looking at the relationship between the health of a national economy and women's rights or child marriage and national instability, how do you show that those relationships are causative rather than a correlation with some intervening variables such as national politics, history, culture, et cetera? And the second question is, that one of your key recommendations was engaging our foreign policy more through diplomacy to promote these goals. And I'm curious, even if national governments abroad kind of sign on to these goals in our foreign policy, given that these issues are so deeply cultural, how do you kind of instigate buy-in at a local community level, given that even if governments sign on, it may not have impact on the ground?
Those are great questions. Why don't I take the cultural question first? I think there are kind of two answers to that. One is that in a lot of the countries where you see these issues are in play, let's just take child marriage as the example, as we were talking about that earlier. There are many countries where child marriage is incredibly prevalent, where you actually have indigenous groups who are campaigning strongly against the practice. So the interest in ending this practice exists in those countries, and women and girls who have endured this practice have expressed their sentiment that they wish that it would no longer continue. So I think that, you know, when we're asking a question about culture, I think one obvious answer to that is, you know, how are we defining culture? Whose culture are we talking about? And are we including the women and girls who endure this practice as we make that assessment, or the advocates who are working to end it? I think we've also seen examples where a government like the U.S., for example, can support indigenous efforts and really work with religious and tribal leaders, local leaders, to educate them about the effects of this practice and work with them together to end it, because I think it's an excellent point that, you know, imposing a perspective from the outside as opposed to working with people is not a recipe for success. So an example that we talk about in the report is an organization called Tostan, which works in Senegal to eradicate child marriage and also the practice of female genital mutilation. And Tostan has community empowerment and engagement programs that really educate local leaders about the harmful effects of these practices, and then those local leaders in turn educate communities. And many, many, many communities across Senegal have now pledged, as a result of this program, to end the practice of child marriage and now increasingly female genital mutilation as well. We've seen other programs in other countries. So, for example, in Yemen, there was an Oxfam program that focused specifically on community awareness and economic empowerment that, again, was shown to be effective. So I think that it absolutely makes sense to engage with local leaders, with religious and tribal leaders, and also to engage men and boys as allies in trying to end this practice.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from University of Northern Iowa.
Hi, this is Dr. Catherine Zeman at University of Northern Iowa, and I think you kind of answered some of what I had wanted to ask with just the previous question, but I was looking for practical action ideas in the field. Do international health work and work in areas where health disparity is a major issue and often see the situations that you've described. So can you identify any, you know, if you were going to focus on one practical action, what is the best thing a person working in the field could do?
That's a great, great question. You know, there are some who say that if there were to be a silver bullet to end, for example, a practice like child marriage, that one would point to girls' education because of the transformative potential that it has, because it empowers a girl economically, because her health and educational outcomes are likely to be stronger as well as those of her children. But I think that the more prudent approach would really to point out that these are issues that cross sectors. They really are cross-sectoral, and you need a multifaceted approach to make sure that you're addressing deep-rooted problems like this. There's a great publication that the International Center for Research on Women has put out that really surveys child marriage programs all over the world and identifies the strongest factors that contribute to success. So I commend that report to you. I think that's an excellent place to look in terms of finding examples of what's worked, but also principles for guiding work on the ground to address issues like this. There are some examples in the report on child marriage that we put out earlier this year that I think are interesting. So, for example, in Ethiopia, where child marriage is a significant problem. Actually, we've seen, because of, in part, commitment by the government to lower the rate of child marriage, we've seen that in parts of Ethiopia the rate has come down. But in the Amhara region, it's really a significant issue, and about half of the girls there are married before the age of 15. And about 25% of them give birth before the age of 18. And in that region, there's a program called Brahini Hiwan that was funded by the United Nations and the Nike Foundation that offered a goat and school supplies to families who kept their children in school and delayed marriage for 2 years. And that program, the results showed that girls were about 90% less likely to be married. So really significant when kind of the economic incentives to marry girls early are shifted by a program like that. A similar program has been ongoing in India, where, as I've mentioned, there's a significant problem with child marriage. That program is called Apni Betty, Apni Daan, or translated to Our Daughters, Our Wealth. And what that program did essentially was endow a savings account upon the birth of a girl that she would be entitled to, along with her family, if she remained unmarried by the time she turned 18. And all of the girls who were enrolled in that program are just now turning 18, so that program is actually being evaluated right now, but the preliminary results are promising. So, you know, that's, I think those are two examples of programs that have been effective in kind of shifting the incentives to marry girls early. I think girls' education is critical, but because this issue has effects on health, has effects on economic growth, has effects on education. There are really, I think, a number of ways that it can be and should be addressed.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from University of Kentucky.
We've seen how very often in these kinds of issues that it's high-level leadership that puts the importance on that issue, and it filters into American foreign policy. To what extent do you think that Secretary Clinton's interest in this area has really been deeply institutionalized within the U.S. Foreign policy apparatus? And do you think that that really will continue? We know there are very many women working on this issue, but what degree of commitment do you think there is to follow through with this after her very much high-level attention to the issue?
That is an excellent question, and yeah, I had the good fortune of working for Secretary Clinton in her Office of Global Women's Issues at the State Department, and one of the things that was top of mind to us really the whole 4 years was how we could ensure that the work that we were doing would last after her departure, and that is something that I think we are seeing the fruits of today. So the one example I can give is the policy guidance that Secretary Clinton issued on gender equality as a tool to advance our foreign policy objectives. That guidance had really important pieces that continue to guide the work of the State Department. So, for example, all department bureaus and key embassies under this guidance have to develop a strategy to promote gender equality and advance the status of women and girls, which will be incorporated into their bureau and embassy strategic planning processes. That is a significant advance, and that continues today. Monitoring and evaluation is another area where there was a big push and commitment to adding indicators to measure outcomes for women and girls and related to gender equality as part of the standard work, in particular the development work that the U.S. government does. There were indicators added on issues like gender-based violence, on women, peace, and security. Those indicators continue to exist, and our government continues to collect information and analyze our success against those benchmarks. Management and training is another area that was outlined in the guidance as an area of focus. And I think we see a continued focus in that area as well. So while Secretary Clinton was in office, the Foreign Service Institute reformed its curriculum to include a module on gender equality that now will be part of the standard curriculum that Foreign Service officers receive, and also added a class on gender equality that is really an advanced level class for Foreign Service officers who want additional training beyond what they receive now in their standard training. That work continues. Those classes continue to be offered, and I understand from some of my former State Department colleagues that the numbers, the enrollment numbers continue to go up. I think it's also critical to highlight Secretary Kerry's commitment to this issue. He's made some very strong statements supporting the inclusion of women's issues as a strategic objective in U.S. foreign policy work. Certainly that commitment continues for USAID Administrator Raj Shah. And then, of course, most importantly, at the top of our government, President Obama's commitment to these issues, which I think is evident not only in the many executive orders and presidential memoranda and other steps he's taken to really institutionalize these issues, but also really right from our national security strategy, I think his commitment is clear and continues. Now, all of that said, I think it is critical to continue to beat the drum on this, that there's an Office of Global Women's Issues at the State Department to continue to push these issues forward. I think there are plenty of people for whom these issues remain secondary or ancillary or quote-unquote soft issues. There's a lot of people who maybe even appreciate the importance of these issues but don't necessarily know how to go about integrating them into their day-to-day work. So I think there is a lot of work that remains to be done, but I do believe that the kind of the bones that were put into place over the last several years will continue to bear fruit.
Next question.
Our next question comes from Lafayette College.
What do you think is going to be the most effective forum for the for the United States to push this policy? The United Nations, or is like visiting and working with countries one-on-one going to be more effective way to actually promote this issue?
That's a great question, and I think the answer is both. You know, we have a lot of work to do through our kind of bilateral relationships, and I think that sometimes quiet diplomacy can almost be more effective than public diplomacy. There's a lot that can be accomplished behind closed doors. There are ways to try and improve the situation and see the outcomes that we want to see without publicly shaming other countries. I think there's a lot of important bilateral work to be done. Of course, that requires leadership, as someone else on the call has mentioned today. You need a leader at the top to make sure that these issues are on the table when those bilateral conversations take place. But multilateral relationships are critical as well, and there's a lot of work to be done at the United Nations. I've flagged in particular the post-2015 development goal process. I think that's a critical place where there will be a lot of focus on gender issues in the coming years. I think it's also well worth noting that the 20th anniversary of the fourth UN World Conference on Women that took place in Beijing in 1995 is almost upon us. And there will be an effort at the UN and elsewhere to really mark that anniversary by thinking about the progress that we've made in the almost 20 years that have elapsed, but also the road ahead and what we need to do to be making progress in the future. So I think the answer is both.
Next question.
Our next question comes from San Diego State University.
Good morning, Ms. Finkelstein. My name is Karen Kluchanek. Thank you for your work and your time with us today. I was wondering if you could touch on the difficulties associated with data collection in rural areas of countries with age limitations already in place regarding marriage, however, sometimes still house weddings posed as a single wedding. However, they can often include a second or third secret wedding to much younger female children.
That is an excellent and very knowledgeable question, and I think data collection in this area is a really critical issue. In fact, there's a whole section of the report that I put out that focuses on monitoring and evaluation and data and research and highlights some of the gaps that exist. You identified one, and there are many others, regional gaps, as I mentioned earlier. And also, interestingly, we have very little understanding the extent to which exceptions to minimum age of marriage laws are employed in countries around the world. So I think there are a lot of outstanding questions that would be important to resolve as we think about the best policy solutions to address this issue. And I think the U.S. has an important role to play, both internally and externally. Internally, we need to make sure that we're pushing dollars to support data collection and research in this area. And then externally, we need to use our voice on the boards of, you know, institutions like UNICEF, which does incredible work on child marriage and on data collection in this area, to make sure that we are supporting their efforts to get even better information and to answer questions exactly like the one that you posed.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from University of Puget Sound.
My question, it seems like you really made the case here. So what are the biggest challenges coming from, like, the U.S. side? And I think you've made it pretty obvious that, like, it's something that needs to be done, but, like, what is still holding us back?
That is another great question. I think that certainly we've seen that there are certain leaders in the U.S. government who have really taken on these issues in a big way. I think we've seen, you know, from the Violence Against Women Act legislation that passed and the leadership of Senators Durbin and Snow and Representatives McCollum and Schock that there are some really strong voices in Congress on this issue. I think also we've seen commitment, as I mentioned, in the current administration to addressing this issue. That said, it requires resources and it requires day-to-day effort. And I think that some of the recommendations that we make in the report in terms of how we can elevate this issue in our diplomacy on a kind of day-to-day basis, and particularly how we can target resources. So we spend, as I mentioned, a substantial amount of money on global health, on education, on economic growth, on human rights and the rule of law, and other programs, democracy promotion, around the world. And it is insufficient to say, yes, we care about this issue, without tying that to programs and to dollars. And there's a chart in the report that actually outlines funding streams. And my recommendation is that the government pull together an interagency group to really look across those funding streams and figure out exactly in concrete terms how we're going to use our dollars and make sure that the programs that we have on the ground incorporate this issue in a significant way. And part of that is also about the monitoring and evaluation, because if we are measuring the success of these programs based on the outcomes we see in this area, in part, then we are going to spend more dollars and more time planning for that. So that's also a significant piece of the equation. So I think we're really in a very hopeful time in the sense that there's been a push to elevate this issue on the U.S. agenda, and also, as I mentioned earlier with respect to the post-2015 process, on the international agenda. But there's a lot of work that still remains to make sure that that rhetorical commitment is translated into our policies and programs and, most importantly, into the dollars that we spend.
Next question.
Our next question comes from Tuskegee University.
Yes, it seems that the U.S. government's involvement in affairs of other nations seems to have caused an increase in resentment and anger towards our government. So I was wondering, should the U.S. involvement in these issues be through our government or through the American public being made more aware and through encouraging volunteerism and activism?
That's a great comment. I think, you know, there's really a role to play for kind of both avenues rather than just one. The U.S. is basically working on development issues and in countries around the world on issues that are related to and cross over with this issue. And so the case that I'm making is that if we want to succeed in those global health programs, if we want to succeed in those education programs, if we want to promote economic growth, then we have to address this issue. But I agree that we need to support indigenous efforts. I think that's a lot of what we recommend in the report, and so many of the examples that we show are about supporting those local efforts. And I think there's an incredible role to play by the American public in terms of expressing their support for programs to address this issue, for diplomacy that addresses this issue, and also volunteerism is incredibly important. There are really great organizations, many of them religious organizations, that are doing critical work on women's rights issues around the world, on FGM, on trafficking, on child marriage. The American Jewish World Service, for example, I know has really just made a pretty substantial commitment to addressing the issue of child marriage through its programs, but I know there are many, many other examples like that. So I think there's really a role for both.
Next question.
Our next question comes from United States Military Academy at West Point.
Good afternoon, ma'am. Thank you for taking my question. My question comes in the context of the Amina Falali case in Morocco, in which a 15-year-old rape victim was made to marry her rapist and subsequently committed suicide from the abuse she endured. So conjugal rape is not really perceived as a crime in some of these cultures, but sex outside of marriage is still punishable. And from a Western perspective, this makes little sense, but sometimes this is seen as a necessary system to preserve social order. And it seems as if many parts of the world are approaching a chance to have a social dialogue on these issues, as Morocco did following Amina Falali, but illiteracy among women in some of these countries is upwards of 50%. So how do we make sure that these conversations that happen are representative and that our views, our American views, regarding sexual freedom don't overcome traditional values that govern social order?
That's a really thoughtful and important question. And I think you're absolutely right about the sensitivities that you raise in terms of the best way to approach these issues when we work on them in other countries. And I think the answer is really to enlist the support and to work with people on the ground, because that's really the way that our efforts will be most successful. And Morocco is a really interesting case because we've seen over the last several years in particular a lot of interesting developments there in terms of how women's rights are treated. There was a family reform in Morocco where Moroccan women came together and really answered opposition to promoting women's rights in religious terms, noting liturgical support for family law reform. And they really prevailed and now have the right to custody over their children. I know that there's a fluid situation there, but I think that's an example of where enlisting the help of religious and local leaders can be instrumental in working on these issues. All of that said, I think that part of what your point also speaks to is kind of the kind of constellation of women's rights and legal rights issues that are relevant to ensuring that the practice of child marriage is addressed. You know, if women are not allowed to own property, that limits their economic potential. If women are not permitted to go to school, that limits clearly their education, but also their economic potential. If women don't have the right to travel to obtain the health care they need, again, all of that affects their broader status in society and really feeds into the status, the low status that women and girls have, which often makes them economically dependent and therefore makes them more susceptible to these practices taking place. So I think the other important point that your comment flags is that in addressing child marriage, it's insufficient from a legal perspective to think only about establishing a minimum age of marriage law. We need to think about the host of legal issues that either constrain women's status and rights in society or promote them.
I think we have time for one more question.
Our next question.
Go ahead.
Our next question is from New York Academy of Medicine. Please make sure your phone is not on mute.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Yeah.
So my question is, especially with the epidemic of chronic disease around the world and with an aging global population, I feel like we should be interested in women's health and productivity across the life cycle. And the examples that you gave around maternal and child health seem to focus on helping women for the sake of healthy children. On the other hand, you talked about emphasizing women's leadership at the table, and I wonder if there's room in this policy agenda to focus.
Attention, please.
What?
Hello, everybody.
I also understand that there are so many issues around security and stability that we might not be there yet.
I think that's a great point. And with respect to global health, the U.S. government has made a focus on women's health and on women and girls and their status in society kind of foundational principle across the global health programs that the U.S. engages in. So that is far beyond just maternal health or family planning, for example. That it really includes the range of global health programs, HIV, AIDS, malaria, TB, and on and on. So I think that you're making an important point. With respect to talking about child marriage, you know, the reason that I focus in the report on maternal mortality is because of the strong relationship between early marriage and early pregnancy and childbearing, which is the leading cause of death for girls at age 15 to 19 in the developing world, and because of the strong correlation between that unfortunate side effect of child marriage and stillbirth and infant mortality. But I think you make an important point that, first of all, addressing women's health is important in its own right. Not simply as a kind of instrumentalist approach to improving the health of children and communities. On the other hand, it's important to note that that side effect exists because women often are the purveyors of health care for their family around the world and also here in the U.S., and therefore their health and education has a direct effect on the health and education of their children and families. But I think you're absolutely right that global health has important ramifications economically and otherwise in a society, and that we should be looking at women's health over the lifespan. And that is certainly something that I think the U.S. government is doing through its global health work more broadly.
Great. Thank you so much, Rachel. I apologize to all of you who did not get to ask your question. We had many still in queue, but we are at the end of our hour. So I hope you will take a look at Rachel Vogelstein's report. We sent out a link in advance, as well as visit our website for other resources. Our next call will be on Thursday, October 24th. Max Boot, our senior fellow for National Security Studies, will discuss non-traditional warfare. And I hope you will follow us at CFR_academic for new information on our resources and upcoming events, as well as take a look at our new dedicated students homepage at cfr.org/students, where you can find information on calls such as these events and resources that are suited for your research and your study for midterms and the like. So I hope you will take a look at that. We are also going to be featuring students who are using CFR publications. So write in, let us know what you've liked to read and how you're thinking about things. Email us at educators@cfr.org. So thank you all, and thank you, Rachel.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.